Welcome to The Peg Doesn't Fit. The Peg Doesn't Fit is a podcast about the need for an educational paradigm shift. We have not quite decided if education is the whole or if it is the peg, but one thing is for sure, it doesn't fit.
Join us each week as we explore our metaphor and discuss the need for a systematic shift in the American educational system.
My name is Eric Steven.
And I'm Ryan Bartle. Welcome to The Peg Doesn't Fit.
Today we have Dr. Nick Sutton from Addison Number 4 in Chicago. That's a school district. He's superintendent there. And he's also the author of two books. Welcome to the show, Nick.
Hey, thanks for having me. I'm excited. I'm thrilled. I enjoy this kind of stuff. So thanks for giving me the chance to kind of fill my bucket.
You're welcome. Good to have you here. We've also got Quiet Man Eric Steven on
the Sorry. Sorry, I thought, Ryan, you're just going to introduce him and roll in. Here I am. Hello,
Let's
everybody.
Talk about these two books, Nick. Make Professional Development Matter and The Post-COVID School. Give us a quick synopsis of it. We want to know, not just the books, but how did you get to, you even called yourself, I think, a baby principal one time, but you were once probably a baby teacher. So how did you get from there to here?
Oh, boy. You know, I'll start it out like this. As a guy who's checked out some of your guys' episodes and other podcasts, I've noticed that a lot of times people kind of say they're a high school person or an elementary person. I'm here to say, first and foremost, I'm a middle school guy. I know. It's like a bald middle school guy connection or something. I loved middle school, and I loved being a teacher in a middle school, and I had the chance to get empowered a little early in my career, and I was a middle school principal at the age of 28, and I loved it. And so sometimes when I kind of refer to like early principal type things, it's because, you know, being an administrator for, I think, 12, 13 plus years now, you kind of learn some things. So how I fell into kind of where I'm at now is I loved everything middle school. I was middle school principal at a couple of different settings, got a chance to become a superintendent. And I think if one thing that I've learned is there's no such thing as luck. You either take advantages of opportunities or somebody else will. And I've been very fortunate to just come across some really great opportunities. I would say in terms of the books, if anybody out there has ever worked on a doctorate, the one humbling experience about that is for every 10 pages you write, there's some really wonderful people on a dissertation chair that make you cut out about 5 pages of it. And so when I finished my doctorate, there are huge chunks of stuff that I was really proud of, that I'm like, what do I do with this?
Yeah.
And that honestly kind of became the genesis to my first book. Mm-hmm. I wrote my dissertation on the relationship between instructional strategies that not only impact kids' learning, but also correlates and connects to a positive climate. And that's how I really became really invested and passionate about it, because I remember as a year one teacher sitting in school improvement days, and I watched one teacher knit. I watched another guy put his glasses on funny and try to make other people laugh. And I just remember it really left an impression on me. I'm like, whoa, like this is not what I expected. And then as a principal, I can remember working so hard on like professional development and some sort of institute or teacher meeting. And there was nothing more disheartening than like a teacher coming, man, I don't think that applied to me. And just being like, this should be the pinnacle of what we do. We get mm-hmm. together and we're collegial and we talk instruction. And so
yeah.
That's really what became the reason I really wanted to do that first book. And that first book really talked about, there's really two things I've realized and I've kind of based everything I do upon. And it's based upon research. Is like, if you want to improve student achievement, you have to improve instruction. There's just no two ways around it. Like it has to be professional development based upon student engagement. And so sometimes while I see a place for professional development based upon different aspects of a school, whether that's hallway behavior, that's important, or whether it's dismissal procedures, that's important. But if you want to improve instruction, you have to improve instructional strategies that connect to student engagement. And then the other kind of piece to that book is, push comes to shove, if you want to improve climate, you have all these different ideas, but the one unequivocal thing that I found in my research that connected to a bunch of other research that was in both my dissertation and this book is, it all comes down to administrative support. If a teacher doesn't feel supported by their administrator, climate falters. And so I think it's one of those things that we in education, we can keep things as simple or complex as we let it become. And so I just really kind of let it become as simple as I am able to let it be. You want to improve student achievement? All right, we got to have better instruction. Doesn't mean that I don't think you're a great teacher. Doesn't mean that I don't think you work hard enough. If your data, if you're not satisfied with it either, we have to improve your instruction. And we connect that to the student engagement. And if you want to improve climate, it all comes down to, do you feel supported by your administrator? Yes or no? And so to me, it's like, those are kind of been the two driving principles that drove that first book and a lot of where I'm at. And then for the second book, if anything, I, like a lot of people going through that pandemic, it really felt like I ended up becoming, because there was a bunch of other contributing authors that wrote chapters in that book. But what that really was is the book that I wish existed when everything was happening with COVID, because it was like, okay, what should we be doing? What should this look like? And what is going to be the result of this after all this is done? And so that really is what it became. I'm proud of the post-COVID school, because there's a chapter on what a library should be like now post-COVID. There's a chapter on how you should teach reading now due to COVID. There's a chapter of what leadership and the change process should look like post-COVID. Because I think the analogy really with that was, if your house burned down, if you truly had your house burned down that you had to rebuild from scratch, would you put the kitchen exactly where it is now? Would you maybe make that bathroom a little bit bigger? Would your garage be a little bit wider? And so in a lot of ways, public education burnt down during COVID. So are we going to really rebuild back the exact same way it was?
Okay, so this episode's primarily going to be about professional development, but I am curious about the post-COVID school, because Ryan and I started this kind of right in the middle of COVID. And, you know, we thought, okay, so COVID, terrible thing. It was a terrible thing for our society. I mean, it kind of put everything on shutdown. But at the same time, we thought, maybe this is what education needs to springboard us into the future, right? Yeah. So we can finally start getting use out of the technology that we have to help drive our instruction and make it more relevant for kids. And then we all came back to school, and school just kind of picked up where it left off. Do you have any examples of maybe how that integration of all of those thousands of applications and whatnot that we learned during COVID is still being used effectively, even though the kids are back?
I think if anything, going through that process probably became the most honest, accurate feedback teacher evaluation system that teachers never asked for. Because if you weren't able to be engaging through a Zoom link, the kid would just log out. And what are you going to do about it?
Mm-hmm.
And so I think it became the catalyst of a lot of conversations across our entire field of, if you just do lecture for 45 minutes, this is now the epitome of kids will disconnect. They can't stick with it. And so I recall like professional development that was, you know, it started with like just, you know, being able to use a resource. How can you use Google Classroom or Seesaw to do breakout rooms and to assign kids different independent projects that are based upon their interest and their ability? You know, how can you assess kids at a different pace? Because you got one kid, they're only going to log on for an hour. There's nothing you can do about it because they got to watch their other kids. And you got another kid that will log on for 24 hours a day if you let them, because they are eagerly wanting that engagement. And so it, to me, it's like, there was a, it was another way of showing, unless you do this real constructivism type approach where it's student led in terms of the pacing, and they have some sort of voice in terms of the interest, and you just control the skill acquisition, those were the teachers that were most successful during COVID. They were the ones that kept kids engaged. And so now it's like, what better action research do you need to now equip that into your own classroom now? If you're a teacher that knows your content forward and backwards, but you are still just doing nothing but direct lecture while the kids are just passive recipients of the knowledge you're trying to instill, you're not getting as much gains as you could.
Do you, in either of your two books, I'm also thinking of a lot of professional development that I attend that also struggles in that same area.
You know? That's a great point.
Does your book address that? Like, how do you become a dynamic Zoom professional developmenter? Or even, I think, same way it transfers into that classroom, like, do you address, how do you not just become a lecturer of a professional developer?
That is such a great point. Because you could even make the argument, you know, how many, as a former principal, but, you know, the current principals that are out there, do you do that same approach in a staff meeting? And then do you wonder why you see people disconnect after a while and look at their phone? So I'm going to kind of answer your question in two ways. Like, specifically, I think the post-COVID school does have some chapters that really articulates how best to incorporate hybrid remote learning, because in some ways it's here to stay. Like, it's, there's always going to be aspects of that. And I think it's a positive thing. I think more broad, in my first book, really talk about before, and in a lot of ways, before you can do quality instructional professional development, there has to be some sort of curriculum pacing guide. Yep. And what I mean by that is I wholeheartedly believe in teacher instructional autonomy, but there has to be some sort of overarching guide of what skills you teach and when. And the more that I do this, and there's so much research that aligns to this, there has to be a foundational of these skills. And so in third grade, second quarter, let's say, for example, you have to address the skill of analogies for the sake of argument. Now, I might say, third grade teacher, oh, you love your bat unit? That's fine. Use your bat unit, but you have to teach analogies. That skill has to be addressed. Now let's have a conversation on the most engaging way to do so. And the reason I kind of bring that up first is I really believe a district can only go so far, especially the bigger that they are, if you've got certain levels of student in, mobility, and there has to be that foundation of what skills are going to be taught when, and it has to be universally accepted and believed in. Mm-hmm. When you have that, I then think that another necessary step is some sort of SMART goal that's objective. Okay, if we do professional development on differentiation strategies, if we do professional development on informal walkthroughs, if we do student engagement on how just to define what that is, how do we know this went well? And so once you get that foundational curriculum and then a big teaching staff to say, you know what, if our MAP score is increased by 2%, that's how we're going to measure that what we did was worthwhile. I really feel like it's only then that you can actually say that you objectively improved instruction. Because I feel like without those two pieces, it goes so far back into, you don't want to do some sort of professional development and then 6 months later say, how did it go, and have everybody went. It went pretty well. It was cool. That's just not enough for a lot of people. So in terms of specifics, I am the biggest champion of informal peer walkthroughs as any administrator you've ever met. Awesome. I think that is the catalyst to kind of best answer your question.
Yeah. And I would argue, you know, stepping back to your, if we make 2% increase on MAP, I still think that unless you're digging into that data to determine what the overall weaknesses are that we need to improve on in order to make those 2% gains, then that's when you can look back and say, okay, our work impacted our scores versus just having PD over a variety of topics just because that's the flavor of the week. And then all of a sudden you look at the spring and you compare your spring scores to your fall scores and you got better, mm-hmm. but the professional development wasn't necessarily guided towards their specific weaknesses. I don't know if we can always take credit for that, or if that's just a testing company designing a test to show progress so they can show districts how awesome their program is.
I couldn't agree more, because I think if anything, if we all go back in time about 10 years ago, everybody was going one-to-one with Chromebooks and laptops. And that was such a futuristic, exciting thing. And I made this mistake. I thought that was the greatest thing in the world. I championed that as a principal. And in a lot of ways, it was, I lived through a one-to-one Chromebook implementation. And we thought there was going to be this magical correlational silver bullet that was just going to make student achievement go up. And it really didn't. Because what we did is we gave teachers and kids a really valuable resource, but we didn't actually improve their instruction.
Yeah.
And if you really go back in time, like 15, 20 years ago, some of these states that really were at the forefront with one-to-one iPad and laptop programs, none of them really saw an improvement in student achievement. It all goes back to, you have to improve instruction to improve student performance.
Talk about how teacher cooperation might look in a building and what's necessary. You kind of, and just reiterate this maybe through this lens, because you've kind of just addressed all this, but we had Darlene Opfer from RAND on the show just recently, and she was talking about some of her PD research, and she said it was level of teacher cooperation and having a strong instructional leader, and you've added to that. How would you incorporate those two?
I think if anything, in terms of like having the type of climate that teachers embrace this, there has to be feedback outside of evaluations.
Yeah.
And I think, I don't know of another way to do it other than there has to be some type of system of walkthroughs. Mm-hmm. There has to be, and it has to come with just a sense of visibility with the building principal going into classrooms, so they garner that type of credibility that they know what's going on. And I can't tell you how many times it's been fun. It really has been fun to a certain extent, because I've done it in a variety of different ways, even outside of the districts that I've been fortunate enough to work at, where you get two veteran teachers that have been next to each other for decades, and you say, what's the name of her kids? They know it. What kind of pizza is their favorite? They know it. And then you say, what is their preferred instructional strategy to begin a unit? And they look at you like, why in God's name would I know that? And it's like, that's a problem. That's a real problem. Yeah. Why do we work in a field like that? And I don't know how else to do that besides saying, whether you call it PLC time or teen time or whatever else, you have to set up a system where teachers feel comfortable and see the need to go into other teachers' classrooms. Yeah. And to like really scale it down, if you got teachers to say, that terrifies me, that's a problem. You can't improve instruction until or unless teachers feel vulnerable to a certain extent and feel safe to do so. And it won't and it can't happen just in a yearly, some sort of evaluation. And so I know for me, we do a student walkthrough model that's based upon levels of student engagement. And we define student engagement. And rather than getting like overtly detailed with it, there is a place for just direct instruction. You have to explain that stuff. You have to do that. But how often do you actually have kids working in cooperative groups that are driven upon their interest? And some teachers say never. And I think the more that you address and create that type of climate, the better. And then to answer your other part of the question, to make it as simple as I can, if you're a principal for me, you have to be an instructional expert. No. You have to lead PD. People have to see you as a resource. Because without that level of leadership and skill level, I don't know how else you created a climate of continual improvement.
How do you ascertain that as a superintendent when you're looking for that? Because I am actually, this does not make me a strong instructional leader specifically, but I feel like I have a level of what's out there, what's going on, what are the trends. Fill in the blank, not just because of this show, but because of the podcasts I listen to, blah, blah, blah. I have that in a level that exceeds most anyone I meet. And in that way, I feel like I don't even have an acceptable level almost. So So what I guess what I'm getting at is like how, what is acceptable maybe is the question for what a principal should know. And how do you decide that? Because I look around and go, how could you be good if you don't even know that this is a thing? Or I don't really know how to ask the question, but I'm just wondering, yeah, in hiring practices, how do you make sure? What defines a strong instructional leader?
I think a lot of times I start with, tell me how you define student engagement. And if you really have people unravel that, I think it can be forthcoming, because some people give an answer that connects to a kid is compliant. Student engagement is all the kids are sitting there. All the kids are in rows. All the kids are looking at me. All the kids. And to me, I just hear that's a passive learner.
Yep. Yes.
And don't get me wrong. There is a place for that. And there's a certain level of skill level to create an environment like that. But if that demands their definition of student engagement, I can't connect that to an instructional leader. If they start talking about student engagement is a kid that works independently, a kid that is differentiated in terms of assessment, if they have a voice in terms of content, as long as it's connected to mastery of a skill, that's looking through a lens of instruction. And the other way that I really get at this is school improvement plans are a big deal to me.
Yep.
And I will constantly work towards this. I have not reached the pinnacle of perfection by any means with what I'm about to say, but ideally every staff member in a school should know the goals of a school improvement plan, and they should have an idea of where they're at in the process. And a school board should know what each school's school improvement plan targets are. They should be advertised, and there should be a climate where if a school has not reached that target, they report it, and they're vulnerable. And they say, we need help. We need these resources. Because I think unless or until there's that real focus on what is student engagement and school improvement plans that connect to professional development to improve and reach the targets that they're reaching, it's hard. So I think the best answer to your question, it'd be, do you really see the value of school improvement plans and defining what true student engagement is? That's an instructional leader. That's an instructional leader to me.
I like to hear you say
that. Oh, go
ahead. Well, I was just going to say, I like to hear you say that, because so often my experience has been, you know, we get those Bloom words out and Costas, and we try to create these questions or these stems of what we're going to work for, you know, and they're so perfectly worded, and we spend so much time deciding, okay, what exactly is our goal going to be? And then a month later, you could probably do a survey of a school and any school throughout the country, you know, just of which teachers know what those goals are. And it'd probably be pretty low, you know, but I would assume that a school that is a high achieving school, everybody's working towards the same goal, and professional development should all be geared towards making sure that we are doing what we need to do to achieve those goals. And then we should be checking data intermittently throughout to see if we're making progress and it seems so simple when you think about it, but then all the kids show up and it's like,
you know, it's so well said. And I see superintendents and school board members, they make a similar mistake in the same way. Like if you guys looked up the strategic plan of 100 school districts, I would almost bet money it's going to some something, something community, something, something financially responsible, something, something achievement, something, something. I mean, that
productive citizens.
Yes. And I cannot remember where this is cited. I've read before that something like 3% of those things actually come to fruition.
Right.
Because they're too subjective and they don't get down to the core of it. You just got to peel down, improve instruction, improve climate. How do you do that? Professional development based on student engagement, administrative support. It's that simple. And so we all do it. And I think it's fascinating to me because like since like I think it's the late 1970s, our field has exploded on research.
Uh-huh.
We know what works. Like one example off the top of my head, like summer school remediation programs largely don't work.
No.
Holding a kid back, retaining them doesn't work. But it's fascinating to me how we have the solutions. We don't have a problem with solutions. They're out there. We have a problem with implementing solutions mm-hmm. either at all or with fidelity. Mm-hmm. Wow. And it's interesting within our field why it's that way. The answers are out there. Mm-hmm. We sometimes just don't implement them, or we work in a setting where we somehow justify that our school is different and unique and it doesn't quite apply.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Our kids should get zeros because it's right. there's no research that supports that. And so I find it exciting and interesting because it's like so much of what we do as educators is we have to just go back to we need to be vulnerable and we need to realize that we work in a career field where you will never reach perfection. You need to always strive to improve. And if you were willing, there's no shortage of answers that are out there.
I'm wondering if when you're thinking through like how much professional development is, let's say, sufficient, is there a bare minimum? Because my district does it very different than the district that Eric is in. And I taught in the district that he's in. And I don't know that one is better than the other, but in his district, does 40, tell me if I'm wrong. Why don't you say what it is after I say what ours is. Ours, we have 7.5 full days during the school year. Some of which is a mix between building and district level, but we actually are pushing towards all building level for this next year because I feel like it's more authentic. So anyway, 8 total yeah. school days or 7.5 or whatever, depending on how you want to count it. Eric, what do you do?
Well, and Nick, this is why I'm a middle school person and probably why you were a middle school person. I mean, the whole concept of teaming, I think, is brilliant and can be so powerful. I don't know how many teams there are out there across the country in middle schools that are actually powerful or if they just kind of complain all the time. But, you know, through our school and a middle school setting, we have 3 professional development days a week that we can work with the teachers every day. You know, I think high schools and elementary schools, they have to get a little bit more creative because they don't have that time. I think elementary schools, they probably build it in sometime when the kids go to their specials or however that works. I don't know. I haven't worked in an elementary school, and high school's got get a little more creative with, like, say, late start days or whatever. But in the middle school, there's opportunity for professional development and score growth like at no other level in education.
Mm-hmm. So here's truly what I think. Is I feel like if there's one thing I've learned as a guy who's worked at, I don't know, 5 or 6 different districts or whatever now, everybody has to understand that everybody has a different pace. Like I even sometimes think of either, you know, personal relationships I've been or others that I know that are in relationships. Both parties have to have a similar pace with life, or it seems like things kind of go off track. And I feel like to a certain extent, school districts are the same. A community is going to have a certain pace that they want to see things happen. A teaching staff is going to have a certain pace. A school board is going to want a certain pace. And if the leader doesn't adapt that pace to a certain extent, things don't go well. I've met and encountered educational leaders that I think are brilliant, that their pace was either really fast or really slow, and they ended up in a district or a community that wanted a pace that was the opposite, and it just doesn't fit. And so in so many ways, professional development has to be organic. I try hard to say, if I got a teacher comes to me with an idea and they're excited, I'm going to say yes. Now let's figure out how we do it. And so there is a place for, you know, late start Mondays, early release Wednesdays, institutes, whatever. And that needs to be valuable, but I see that as the minimum. And then I always try to empower, I got a group that want to take assessments and run, and you want to learn more about this, and you can connect this to your school improvement plan, let's go. Mm-hmm. Yep, I'll get you a sub. Yep, I'll cover your class. Yep, I'll have the principal do this. Like, you have to meet people at the pace that they want to go. And I think as an educational leader, whether you're a principal or a superintendent, you get a sense of the overall pace of a district, and it's your job to just push it a little bit faster. It's kind of like if you're jogging on a treadmill. If you're comfortable at a 6 mile per hour pace, all right, we need to do 6.5 because 7 is not going to go well. 5, you're not getting anything out of it. And 6 is kind of wherever you've always been. So let's push this a little bit more. And so whatever you guys are doing at your district, like if I was a leader in one of those institutions, I would get a sense of that pace and say, we're just going to do a little bit more.
So I like what you said, if you have a teacher that comes at you with an idea, because here's the deal. Our buildings are filled with educational experts. And oftentimes those educational experts are disgruntled in professional development because they don't find it meaningful or whatnot. How do we increase that teacher efficacy and allow perhaps teachers to lead the professional development? I mean, is that something that you do? Because here's my thought, right? So if you're a principal or even a district, even worse, if somebody from the district comes out, you know, that's been removed from the classroom for 20 years, yeah, and they want to come talk to you about a strategy and how it works, but they're all talking textbook, right? It's like watching that video, you know, that the discipline management people put out about how to appropriately manage a classroom discipline, and all the kids are perfect, you know, and you're like, those aren't my kids. Why am I even watching this? So who better to receive professional development from than somebody that works in the trenches with you, that has been successful with a strategy with the same kids that are wearing you out on a regular basis? How do you build that in to provide those experts the opportunity to share their wealth of knowledge?
If anything, it speaks to a big section in my first book where I talk about instructional improvement has to be a combination of in-house experts you empower as well as outside entities. And when you get too lopsided on either scope, it doesn't go well. I've seen some districts where it's like you have one person that all of a sudden decides they're the gatekeeper of all institute days. That doesn't go well. And somebody else who they don't lead anything and they don't let anybody else lead anything and they just hire from outside. It cannot be both ends of the spectrum. I know that, like, when you talk about you have all these in-house experts and sometimes people finally get kind of sour to a building, a lot of times it's because they have an answer to a problem and nobody will listen to them. And it's like you just have to be vulnerable as a leader to say, okay, this is a problem. We're going to do a little data retreat. I know this is a problem. I want to lead a discussion. My goal is to reach an outcome, not to sell you on an idea I have. I think the one thing I've fallen into the most the last couple of years is there is really something to be said of how we define coaching and administration and in an education. Everybody says they like to coach now, but I think to a certain extent, you got to really define what that is, because if all we focus on is coaching people professionally, we're missing the aspect of you've got to connect at a level that people are comfortable with on a personal note. Uh-huh. If somebody is going through a horrific divorce, they're not in a good place to want to improve instructionally or hear anything you have to say. Or if you've got somebody else that just lost a family member due to cancer, they're not interested on your feedback from a student walkthrough. And so I think I see more and more of a place of true coaching and connections and rapport that there's a place for that. And sometimes it's like we see this necessity in a classroom with kids, and there's still these reservations to have this adult to adult. And I think in some ways my brain goes there, because it's like, once you have that level of connection and availability with staff members, who doesn't want to come to you with an idea, or who doesn't feel comfortable to come to you with a problem because they know, whoa, I came to this person 2 weeks ago when I was a total mess. And they just kind of, I know one of the things I love to do is throughout my career, I've sometimes told people, okay, so your contractual time ends at 3:15. I'd like you to come down at 3:16. And if you want to talk to Nick's happy to talk because Nick's a human being. Mm-hmm. And he'd like to talk to you as a human being. And I think it's important to show that side.
Yeah.
I think that's how you truly connect and empower some of that staff population that you talked about.
Mm-hmm. How do you create that? Is it built in through PD? Is it simply leading by example? Is it, let's have a staff retreat. I actually have teachers who say some of it's probably just breaking through this barrier, but they will say that when we do really low, I don't remember what the word is, low risk questions, the kumbaya questions, even if it's that, they say this triggers me and I get really nervous and almost upset. I'm like, wow, okay, we're just trying to get to know you. I don't know. So it feels a little like I know there's no magic bullet, but what is the magic bullet?
I think to a certain extent, it's gotta be, you gotta meet people where they're at, and a leader has to understand that they have to be vulnerable. I know with administrative teams, I cannot remember the name of the book to save my life. And I'm going to remember it as soon as we're done with this episode, where it talks about you really only build teams, whether it's an administrative team, grade level team, middle school team, whatever, it starts with people being vulnerable. And there's this kind of interesting phenomenon when as soon as one person opens up, usually other people do too. And once you have that connection, it kind of, you build from that. There is a very real concept that's called declinism, where I think it impacts public education, but so many of us don't realize it. And basically, here's the premise of declinism. And it essentially is people connect whatever was their happiest time personally, whatever else was going on, they equate that to that being the best. Like, here's a good example. Like, have you ever met like that one teacher where you go, God, we did this so much better 10 years ago. And you go,
right.
What are you talking about? The data was terrible. Our data is so much better right now. How can you say, you know, back in the good old days? And it's fascinating and it's depressing that a lot of times people, that was their happiest time personally. Mm-hmm. If you kind of research this topic, it kind of talks about, that's why, you know, you talk about people that say, you know, back in the good old days, and they equate it to some other decade way back when, where that just happened to be their happiest time. And I think my biggest point is, you have to get people to a point of comfort and get people to a point of trust and rapport with their colleagues and their administration to really ever be able to impact instruction that you want. It's kind of like, you can have a gym membership with all the greatest equipment in the world, but unless or until people feel comfortable to use it and want to learn how to use it, it doesn't matter.
Yeah. Well, listen, you talked earlier in the episode about one of your first experiences at PD was, you know, somebody knitting or trying to make other people laugh. Surely as a principal, you've encountered those teachers that perhaps were not, they did not find professional development a particularly useful use of their time. Do you have any success stories where you've kind of helped a teacher shift from somebody that dreads PD to somebody who looks forward to PD?
I think the most honest answer I give is, I'm going to be a student of that the rest of my life. And yeah. I think any educational leader that says they have the silver bullet solution figured out, you probably should go, I don't know.
Yeah.
I think a lot of it comes back to people. Everybody has a good barometer of who's genuine, who's sincere, and who cares. And I think everywhere I've ever been, I've tried to say, you know what, I have integrity and I get up every morning and I work really hard. And I think when you equate that to being a person that's that's visible. I try really hard, even though I've got 3,500 kids, that I wander around the buildings. I go into classrooms. I like that the kids have an idea of who I am. And I think trying to have that level of, I really do like what I do, and I just want to see kids do well. I think that's how you impact that. Mm-hmm. And to connect it to a lot of the other topics I've brought up, if you really have that person that's really resistant, the right answer is something, and the wrong answer is ignoring it. Mm-hmm. And what I mean by something, it could just be, are you okay? And just see where it goes. And the wrong answer is just going into my office, finding another administrator, say, I can't believe that guy. I'm so tired of this. I just remember a lot of times, especially as a principal, every once in a while you'd have some horrible tragedy. You know, I lived through a kid passing away at a middle school. It was awful. Yep. You know, I've lived through a staff member passes away out of nowhere. You know, a parent passes away. And every time, like, I would always have these wonderful teachers come to me and say, Nick, I don't know what to do. I don't know what to say. And I'd say, here, I can tell you, doing nothing, wrong. Doing anything when you're sincere and you're trying, that's right. Now go be yourself and just go into that classroom. And I think it's the same thing with like professional development and people that resist change and resist improvement and resist feedback. The wrong answer is ignoring it. The right answer is being sincere, rolling up your sleeves and saying, all right, I think I should go try to talk to him. Wish me luck.
What can you say to a teacher that has a building that's low collective efficacy? Maybe the administrator doesn't fit your strong instructional leader profile. Are they just screwed? Or what can they do?
You know, my answer, I think my answer is going to be complex. I think in a lot of ways, it's like, I think life is too short not to love where you're at. Yeah. I can't tell you how many times where I've went to career fairs and I've went up to like some of those student teachers and I'm like, hey, you're great. You go promise me that every place that interviews you, you interview them as much as they are. Yeah. Because I've never met a student teacher that's like, you know what? I picked this career field because I want to be really angry. And in 20 years, I want to walk around and say, I only have this many years left. And in 30 years, I want to talk about this many days until summer. I've never met somebody that entered the field like that, but I've met people that have got to that point. And so as weird as it sounds, like any teacher that just kind of like was like, man, you just kind of spoke to me, I'd be like, why are you wasting your life? Don't do it. And so, but then I would also follow my own advice. If they're like, well, I'm invested in the community and my kids go here, I'd go, okay, doing nothing isn't going to improve anything. Right. Doing something is the right answer. I would absolutely go to that principal and be like, are you okay? Because there's a lot of people that are not happy and you have to sense that. And do you really want to wake up and come to this type of setting every day? And if the principal says, get out of my office, then you go, okay, well, I'm going to look at my circle of influence. And it might be my grade level team. And if they tell you to go away too, then you know what? You got 25 kids every day that you can change their life. And so if that's the only circle of influence you have, then you know what? I'm going to make the most of it.
Yeah.
That's a great answer. Thank you for that. Listen, Nick, I've been super excited throughout this episode. I think it's been a great episode. I think we've had some pretty great dialogue.
Well, thank you.
And I'm hopeful that some of our listeners maybe get inspired. If anybody wants to follow you or learn to add a little bit more information about you or even maybe get in touch with you, how can they do that?
I love Twitter, at Dr. Nick Sutton, S-U-T-T-O-N. If people reach out, I will respond. And I'm one of those people where it's just like, I love this kind of stuff. I used to love conferences because it was just such a great place to meet people. And then this podcast thing, it's like, oh my God. And then it's like Twitter and it's like, everybody is out there and everybody can connect if they want to. So I love talking shop and I just want to get better and I just like what we do. So I'm always lurking around on Twitter at Dr. Nick Sutton is an easy place to find me. And if somebody shoots me a message there, I can't promise it'll be within an hour or a day, but I'll message back and I'll be their friend.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Nick. We appreciate you taking your time to come on the show with us.
Thank you. I've had a ball and we're all in it for kids and that's what it's all about.
As always, thank you for checking us out at The Peg Doesn't Fit. We appreciate you listening. You can find us on Twitter at The Peg Doesn't Fit. You can find me at Ryan D. Bartle 1.
And my personal Twitter is at Eric J. Steven. You can also email us at thepegdoesn'tfit@gmail.com or leave us a voicemail at anchor.fm/thepegdoesn'tfit.
Drop us a 5-star review on iTunes. Tell your educator friends or family, anybody. We'd love to hear from you.
All right. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you next week on The Peg Doesn't Fit.